Okay.
Yeah.
So welcome to This Cycling Life. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Simon Gerrans, an entrepreneur and former professional cyclist. Simon doesn't need a big introduction, a long and very illustrious pro career in which he won Milan-San Remo, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He took victories in all three of the Grand Tours. He was a multiple Australian champion. And also multiple winner of the Tour Down Under. So, Simon Gerrans, welcome to you. And it'd be great to get an update from how you're spending your time right now.
Thanks, Jamie. Well, firstly, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and great to chat with you guys. What am I doing with my days now? So my current role is the CEO of a business called The Service Course, which is a business that a former teammate of mine founded 4 or 5 years ago now. I became involved as an investor in the business about 18 months ago and have since been working within the business for the past 12 months. So recently relocated to Australia, so sort of juggling a number of things with the move here and a young family and settling back in Australia after being abroad for 20 plus years and trying to sort of fulfill my role at Service Course at the same time. So it's a busy period.
Excellent. And still riding your bike a bit. We understand that a couple of days ago you did the Melbourne to Warrnambool, which is not exactly a short ride to throw yourself into.
No, that's right. And so since I stepped away from professional racing, I don't think I'd ridden my bike over 4 hours. And I could probably count on one hand how many times I'd ridden in excess of 100 kilometres. And I got approached about joining a group of guys that were celebrating 125 years of the Melbourne to Warrnambool. And they were doing a 336-kilometre ride on Monday. And I got a week's notice. So I did one long ride on the Thursday beforehand where I did a six-hour ride and I got through that okay. So I thought, hey, what the heck? I'll line up for 330-odd Ks. It took us about 10 hours and needless to say, I'm still recovering.
Unbelievable. Simon, as my background is in helping starting riders, when we look at your resume, so to speak, we see Ringerike as the first team you were on. And then my question comes, wow, that champion must have had a lot of winner's mindset already when he was 18 to race for a Ringerike team that most probably, with all respect for the team, nobody knew. Can you explain how you got there and why?
Well, Team Ringerike, it wasn't my first team in Europe. I moved to Europe when I was 19. And my first team was an Italian under 23 team where I was placed on an associate Australian Institute of Sports scholarship to get some experience abroad. So I raced, my first year abroad was in the year 2000 where I was racing in a small Italian club team. Following that, I raced with the Australian national team, which were based also in Italy for a couple of years. And then as I left the under 23 ranks, it never feels like it's a good time to be trying to break into the pro peloton. But at that point in time, there was a couple of teams fold, a lot of guys on the market, and I didn't have the results to justify a professional contract. I was offered an opportunity with this Norwegian team. The year previous, it was called Team Krohn. They were doing quite an international racing program. So I thought, hey, that could be a good stepping stone to get some experience in some lower level professional racing and hopefully use that as a platform to go into bigger and better things. Unfortunately, the team lost their title sponsor at the very beginning of the year. So it really dropped back in budget. We ended up racing quite a lot on amateur races, quite a lot in Scandinavia. So I didn't really get the exposure that I was looking for in that year, but it was still a big learning experience. It was great to sort of race in some other countries, integrate with my first really, international sort of low-level professional team. The next year after that, I went back to the amateur ranks and competed in France in 2004 by this point. And it was actually racing amateur in France. I really found my niche. I managed to win a bunch of races. Got noticed and turned professional with AG2R the following year.
Yeah. And then yeah, Simon, we spoke recently with Matt Heyman, who, similarly to you, he came over as a very young guy to Europe. And, you know, Matt talked actually about, you know, the joy of racing, the whole adventure, but he also talked a lot about the loneliness and the solitude. I mean, how did you find those early years of, you know, being out here, trying to get some breaks, trying to make it, but ultimately being on your own in a different culture, maybe not speaking the language?
Well, my first year abroad was probably quite tough. I got on the airplane. I didn't speak a lick of Italian. It was just a big adventure. I didn't really know what I was getting into. I just knew I had to get on this airplane and someone was going to meet me at the other end to pick me up and take me to where I was going to be living. That first year was tough. The next couple of years, I was with a group of Australians and I had some great mates in the team. There was a really good camaraderie within the team. It was tough, don't get me wrong. We're all jammed in one team house. Our equipment was pretty lousy and we were getting belted week in, week out by a really high level of amateur racing in Italy at the time. So there were difficult periods. I was probably a little bit homesick on the odd occasion those first couple of years, but I just learned to embrace it. I tried to pick up the language as quick as I could and it just became home being away. And I just sort of got used to being away. And then, next thing I know, it's been 21 years since I was outside of Australia permanently and only just moved back. So there were difficult periods through that point in time, don't get me wrong. But I was really following my passion. I love the competition. I love the training. I love the culture of being European based. So I didn't really feel like I was really sacrificing anything.
Could you give us an example of how you could overcome self-doubt issues or homesickness at some points? Can you, because it's easy to say I overcame it, but can you give an example? Because that's more tangible for a lot of people.
Well, I guess the homesickness type issues, I just tried to create home elsewhere. Obviously you can't replace your family and things like that, but you can definitely try and build a new network of friends. Like I said, I really tried to learn the languages as quick as I could so I could have local friends and understand what was going on locally. So I just really tried to create a new life for myself in Europe. With regards to, what else I was doing to overcome that sort of thing and how I sort of, got through that environment, I just got wholeheartedly into my racing. It was what my whole reason death was about. That was my entire life, was to be there. And I had always had ambitions to get to the next level in my racing career, and I knew that's where I had to be to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, people that we've met over the years who've worked with you, Simon, have always talked about your work ethic. Of all the pros that they've interacted with over the years, you were one of those with the strongest work ethic. Sometimes people will say that, when talent doesn't work hard, hard work beats talent. I mean, what's your view on this balance between natural ability and work ethic and how you find some sort of, ground there?
That's a great saying about the work ethic and the talent itself. But I always said, time and time again, you kind of hear of people saying, oh, there's this guy, he's super talented, he's coming through, he's doing this and doing that. And my response is always, well, talent comes in many ways, shapes and form. Just because you've got a brilliant VO2 max or just because you can ride a certain power to weight ratio doesn't mean you have the resilience to survive overseas and away from your family and friends, or to know how to look after yourself with nutrition and know how to recover and do all those sort of bits and pieces. And I think to be a good professional, you need a combination of all of those things. And you can definitely be stronger in certain areas than others, but you definitely need to be very complete in your approach. And sort of for myself, I never saw myself as the most gifted athlete. There was always many, many stronger guys around, or many guys that I saw were physically more gifted than myself. But I just made a real point throughout my entire career of making the best of what I had. And I really tried to make sure I left no stone unturned, and I did everything I could in every scenario to sort of get the best out of myself.
Is there something particular you did? Because you said, I wanted to give the best of myself. But again, how did you know what was the best? Is there a particular thing you did to find out what was the best for you?
No, I don't think there was one particular thing. And as you sort of look through the teams that I've been racing with, one of the teams that I was a part of for a couple of years was Team Sky. And one of Dave Brailsford, the team principal at Team Sky and now Team Ineos, is favorite sayings. And I thought this is great. He's saying, we don't do one thing 100% better than anybody else. We do 100 things 1% better, So it's not about just saying, I'm better at this one thing than everybody, or I'm doing this one thing that nobody else is doing. It's addressing every touch point of your life and your cycling career to make sure that you're getting the best out of every area. And I even think back to my last year amateur when I was sort of, you know, 23, 24 years of age. I was sort of basically living on my own in a flat in France, moved to a town where I really knew nobody, had some teammates that weren't too far away that I used to hook up with for training rides. And I remember sitting back in the afternoons after training and I'd sit there with a notepad and pen and just write down, okay, this is what I'm doing. What else can I be doing here? How else can I improve that? Whether it was my no diet, my stretching, my training, my equipment, whatever I could do. And I remember just making notes, and then I would call people and talk to them and have different sort of mentors that were a part of my career from the beginning. And I would talk to them about these things and say, hey, I'm doing this ergo session, but I was thinking about changing the efforts in this way, or I was thinking about doing this sort of thing in recovery. What do you think? And I just really try and absorb as much information as I could from everybody around me to really help myself get the best out of every point in my life to become a better bike rider.
Yeah, it's great what you're saying, because I guess what you're talking about here is the link between, you know, it's one thing to have self-belief. There's another thing to have the belief that you're on the line, having done every piece of work that you can to actually deliver the result, which I think what you're talking about is all those things you're doing. But at the same time, you mentioned earlier that you had that love for riding your bike. And so again, and it's interesting you mentioned Dave Brailsford, because he was on an interview recently with Dan Jones on the Detour podcast. And he talked about how in Sky and Ineos, how perhaps they'd lost the, how did he put it? They lost the appreciation for how important fun and joy was for the riders. And that he was seeing now a need to bring that back a little bit, bring back more of the fun and excitement and joy of just the pleasure of doing crazy things in races, you know. What's your take on that? You know, how do you balance this seriousness of the winner's mentality with the joy and enjoyment for the sport?
Well, I think that when you're a professional cyclist, there's nothing more fun than actually winning. And I guess in reflection, you kind of look at Team Ineos this year and their season wasn't successful as what it has been in years gone by. So I guess that's where he's probably feel like that organization is probably starting to feel the weight of not winning and not being that dominant force. So they need to look to other ways to actually really try and lift the mood of the group. So it's good that he's thinking about other ways that he can address this when they're not winning, to go, okay, we maybe not be getting enjoyment out of winning bike races, but we still need to love riding our bikes. What else can we be doing? And when they were out of contention in the general classification, what they're normally targeting in races, it was great to see those guys on the attack and really lighting the race up and racing like they had nothing to lose. So I think that's what they were really trying to do to bring back a bit of spark back into that team.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Australia, Simon, you know, we say winners are grinners. So I understand what you're saying there.
It's interesting. When I listen to that, I hear the entire time that you were even enjoying to have a certain discipline, to have a certain like rhythm and consistency that was helping you both on your winner's mindset, but also in your enjoyment. Are there other points where you see now the things you learned there in that winner's mentality are helping you in building your career further?
Oh, wait, Bernard, can we come to that one in a second? Can we come to that a little bit later? Because I think we'll come to the later career a little bit later in the interview. Is that okay, Bernard? Because otherwise we're going to zigzag all over the place. Why don't we just stick with the experience as a pro before we jump on? So related to that one, I think, Simon, is this, which is, and if I reflect back to seeing you in the final kilometres of many races, you know, whether it was Liège or whether it was Milan-San Remo, you've talked about the physical preparation of getting to the line and having that belief that although not being the strongest guy, you could still beat those who are stronger than you. Maybe you could say watts per kilo kind of Cancellara kind of guys. What about psychologically? Did you have a psychology, you know, a psychiatrist coaching you, or were there particular ways, you know, mantras that you would say to yourself coming into a finish or anything like that to get your head in that right place, knowing that your body was prepared?
No, I never really worked with a psychologist or anything like that throughout my career. I did. There were certain teams that had sort of people around, and again, it was Team Sky that had a psychologist there. So I did do a couple of sessions with him, but I definitely didn't have someone that I would turn to or would visit regularly throughout my career. I never had somebody consistently. I guess the way I always race these races is I always saw that, you know, I had one shot at winning them. And I basically had to gamble everything on that one chance. I wasn't the kind of guy that could follow every attack and then still win, or, you know, or sort of just, you know, play a number of cards. I basically had one card to play, and I backed myself with that. And on a number of occasions, it paid off, and it paid off big. And a number of occasions, I missed out as well. That was sort of how it unfolds. So, yeah, psychologically, I just really tried to focus on the card I had to play or my tactic that I was going to unfold on the day, and back that 100%. And like I said, every now and then it pays off, and it pays off really big. But, you know, I had a couple of big second places throughout my career as well.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And just finally on that winner's mindset, again, I recall seeing you in, I think, Liège the year after you'd won, and I think you crashed out that following year. And just, I remember seeing you, you know, on the TV sitting beside the road with this complete look of kind of dejection on your face or disappointment or whatever it was. I mean, how do you as an individual, you know, pick yourself up, you know, because you've had crashes, you've had broken bones, you've had these setbacks, second places. I mean, how do you keep that resilience to just keep going when you are knocked down in that way?
For me, the key to that is just goal setting. It's really plain and simple. I was always a very goal-oriented person. So whether it was I had a setback through injury, or whether I missed an objective, or whether a race didn't sort of unfold how I wanted to, or, you know, I didn't come up to the right condition that I was hoping to for a goal, for me, it was just about setting new objectives. And yep. As long as I had something to work towards, I could put a plan in place, and then I had a new focus again. For me, the most difficult points throughout my racing career was always after, say, for example, I crashed out of a race and I was on the way to the hospital or something like that, and I didn't know the extent of my injuries because that was that small window of time there where I was just in an unknown period and I didn't know what I was going to be able to aim for. I couldn't set a new goal. Once I had that first diagnosis from a doctor to say, okay, you've done this to yourself, this is going to time frame you're going to be on the sidelines for. At this point in time, you're going to be able to start training again. It's like, okay, if that's the case, I've had this long off, I'll be able to train. There's my new goal. That's what I'm working towards. And from then, I was fine. So for me, dealing with adversity or dealing with setbacks was all about goal setting. And that was a big thing that I really tried to have in place the whole time. And whenever I was, you know, goalless, I was basically rudderless. I was kind of lost. So that's something I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later on in that chat, but that's sort of something I tried to continue really in my career after racing as well.
Okay, great. Hey, so Bernard, why don't we jump now onto the topic of culture, okay, yeah. Like winning culture, and then we'll come to life after pro. So
yeah, no I'm worries, sure no worries, go culture, ahead. Bernard. Yeah. Oh, you mentioned already the Team Sky. Can you compare, like, the winning culture in the teams? Can you give us one example of one thing that you thought was very great in one team as a winner's culture or a winner's mentality as a team, not as an individual, but as a team?
Well, I think the most successful teams have that winning culture within the team. It's never so much just about an individual with a winning mindset. It's about the team really rallying behind a certain team leader, or supporting one another to win the race or to get the best result possible. So for me, that's what it's all about. It's all about having a team buy into the success and having everybody within the team, within the organization, commit to the objective. And that's what creates a winning culture, because all of a sudden, you know, whatever the result, everybody feels like they've contributed to that result. And that's a real winning culture. And I've been a part of teams that have done that outstandingly well. And I've been a part of teams, which is the same organization, that have got that drastically wrong as well. When, you know, not everybody is rowing the boat the same direction, as a metaphor. And in that environment, no one wants to be in there. It's toxic. It's just basically not conducive to performing well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Simon, we had conversations with many pros, you know, who've talked about the old world versus the new world cultures. You know, when they say the old world cultures, they talk about hierarchy, where the DSs are basically directive, the riders are there to do what they're told. And then you have other teams which have a much less hierarchical, much more inclusive and open kind of dialogue, whether it's, you know, pre-race or even during the race. What was your experience there throughout your career, and was there a better way in your view?
There is, I think a hierarchy is important. You know, at the end of the day, the buck's got to stop with somebody, and somebody's got to put their hand up to lead the team and to win the race. So there's always a hierarchy when it comes to who's doing what where to get the result at the end of the day and who's calling the shots. But I think that hierarchy or that order of decision-making or of contribution needs to be pre-agreed and basically signed off on by everybody, all the stakeholders involved. And whether that's a culture where collectively you decide what you're going to do in the race, whether that's one person saying, guys, this is the tactic today. I think that's kind of irrelevant. What the most important thing is everybody's prepared to buy into that. And I've been a part of teams where you sit down, it's a basically big open forum. Collectively, you decide how you're going to go about trying to win the race. And that's worked on occasions. Every now and then, obviously, but more often than not, you know, that doesn't work. And then you have someone that says, right, guys, this is the tactic for today. I've decided, and this is how it's going to work. And again, sometimes that goes wrong and sometimes that goes right as well. So it's not sort of so much about the culture of how that decision's made, it's the culture of whether that decision has been bought into by everybody.
Okay. That's a great one, because I think that was, in a lot of teams, the difference between having a successful year and not a successful year. Would there be one example where you would say, after some sort of a plan that didn't work, what was a very inspiring thing, move that was made by one of the riders or one of the DSs to get it all going again the next day? For example, in the tour, you're getting ready for a certain win. You think, this stage we can win. You have a plan. For some reason, it didn't work. Everybody is a little bit bummed because it didn't work. What comes to mind for you where a very nice example of somebody that took action to get you guys all 120% ready again the next day?
Okay. I'm going to go back to the last Tour de France I competed in. I lined up there with the BMC racing team. The objective of the Tour de France was to win with Richie Porte. You know, that's what we're all there for. That's what we all bought into. And, you know, after, you know, the ninth stage in the Tour de France, which was at that point Richie's kind of a bad omen, it all went pear-shaped. But we had a sensational Greg Van Avermaet in the team who just stepped up to the plate in true leadership form and really carried the team through the Tour de France. He raced above and beyond all expectation, had the yellow jersey for a long period of time. The day he looked like losing it, he extended it. That sort of thing. So I think having a plan B as a fallback plan, I always say you never go in with two plan A's. You can always go in with a plan A and a plan B, but having a plan B with a dynamic leader that has the ability to step up and carry the organization is very, very important. So in that scenario, racing with the BMC racing team in the Tour de France in 2018.
Yeah. Great. So why don't we make that shift now, Bernard, to Simon, talking about, you know, your transition. It's interesting, though, because in conversations we've had with other former pros recently, you know, we've talked about transitions, not just in terms of your pro career and then life after a pro career, but also the transitions that you make during your career. I mean, you turned professional in 2005. You were pro till 2018. That's a big part of your life, 13 years. If you think about the transitions you made from, you know, being an 18-year-old under 23 into the World Tour, Were there things you look back on now, think that you could have done differently or should have done differently? Not just about racing or training, but, you know, about how you looked after your financial planning or thought about your learning and development more broadly. How would you reflect on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, I don't have many regrets throughout my career, my life or anything like that. But hindsight's 20/20. And I think reflectively, you can look back and go, well, if I'd done this and this differently, the outcome might have been a little bit different here. I might be in a different situation right now, for better or for worse. But I would say you make the decisions with all the information you have available at any point in time. And the key is to try and get as much information at any point in time to make those decisions. I think when you get a sniff of something and you run with it, and you haven't really assessed whether that's the best option to take, that's when you can run into problems. But, you know, I guess I look back throughout my career and when I had a couple of options on the table, just even regarding teams, and I chose one team over another team and pondered over that decision for a period of time. I went with a team and, you know, within 6 months, the team I didn't go with had folded. Like, well, that was a lucky decision, you know, because it could have gone either way. And then there are times you go, I extended a contract in a certain team for one contract too long. I should have got out a little bit earlier because I got a little bit stale there. So, you know, I think there are a number of what you can call sliding doors moments that happen throughout your life and throughout your career. And sitting back on reflection, every time I tried to make the best decision possible, you never intentionally make a bad choice. But yeah, I guess there are points in my career that I would have done things differently if I could run them through again. But ultimately, I think from, like you said, I had a good long career. There were definitely some big highs. There were some big lows. I felt like I got, you know, more out of it than I would have ever have dreamed of heading into it. So I don't have too many regrets.
Well, it's with a career like that, I don't think you can, you know, obviously you shouldn't have too much regret, but it's typical what you told earlier, the discipline and the consistency in your preparation to race. To me, it feels like you were doing that also for how you were living and how you would live next year. Is because you talk as if it is natural, but when you look around in the peloton, is it that natural that everybody really looks the way you look? Do you understand what I'm saying? Meaning preparing for pretty much life, although you're racing and on a lot of pressure?
Yeah, but I think you can look at, I was always, you know, taking a long-term view on most things that I was doing, and I was always thinking about what I was going to do when I was done racing. You learn very early on in the piece that you have a shelf life as a professional cyclist or professional athlete. At some day it's going to stop, and you're still a very young person with a lot of life to live after that. And, you know, in cycling, there are very, very few people that exit the sport that are financially secure enough, you know, if they choose to, not to do anything else. I was always a very active person. I don't sit still very well. So I knew in myself, regardless of my financial situation, that I was going to need some projects and going to need some things, some goals to work towards. So I was always really careful to make sure that I had plenty to look forward to after my career. I think a lot of athletes, not just cyclists, athletes in general, probably overvalue their worth to a certain extent and think that because they've been a successful athlete, that the red carpet is going to continue to be laid out for them when they finished their competitive careers, which isn't the case. You're very quickly yesterday's news. So I think it's very important to have a good plan for what you're going to do afterwards. But in saying that, like, I was very strategic, but potentially in the last couple of years, that may have become a bit of a distraction to me as well, because I was thinking so much about, hey, what comes next? Because that day is coming soon. And then the here and now, and really trying to get the best out of my racing.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Simon, because I think that's a dilemma that we've spoken with many current and former professionals about this fear that, you know, thinking too hard about what comes after the career will distract them from the here and now. So that's one we'd love to explore further and we'll be talking with more pros about. You did make a pretty dramatic shift. I mean, you finished your pro career and you went pretty much straight into a trading role with Goldman Sachs in London. Why did you decide on that path? And ultimately, you decided eventually that I understand it wasn't going to be the long-term path for you.
Yeah, so I didn't go directly into a trading role. I actually started an internship at the bank at Goldman Sachs in London in the securities division. And I had a number of mentors throughout my career sort of helping me with, you know, some investment advice and some career advice and some activities to do away from racing. And I was talking to a number of different people about, you know, what path I should take when I was finishing up racing, whether it was to do some study or whether it was, you know, to try and work with a certain business or to stay involved in cycling or go down a route with the media. And through that process, one thing I discovered was, you know, banking was an area where many, many successful people that I'd been associated with had experience. And off the back of that, I started to look into what opportunities there would be in banking. And that's where I come across the internship program that they have at Goldman Sachs. So through a number of people, I managed to get an email contact with the person that I found out was running that program. I reached out to them, sent them some emails, managed to have a phone conversation with them. And they said, yeah, well, this is actually a program that we ran up until about, you know, 2012 or 13, but it's no longer really in existence. And I said, you know, well, I'm interested in it. Is there any way that you could look at me for this program? And they said, well, actually we haven't had anyone of your caliber in sport really apply for the program. So why don't you come over for an interview? Mm-hmm. So that was one of, I think, 23 or 4 interviews that I went through with the bank. And I found out retrospectively, that's, you know, famously a Goldman Sachs way. They really interview everybody. You have to get sign off from a lot of people before they take anybody, accept anybody into the bank, basically, whether it's for an internship or an employment or anything like that. So I went over, I did a huge number of interviews, basically over a 2-year period. Whenever I had a few days off racing or a block where I was having a bit of downtime, I was on a plane to London to go over and do some interviews. And so I basically managed to get sign off and they accepted me as an intern initially for the 2018. Right. And then I got an opportunity to race for one more year at BMC on sort of with an interesting goal. And fortunately, I was able to postpone my internship by one more year and I started it in 2019. So I was planning that for quite some time before I actually stepped away for the sport. And when I was stepping away from cycling, I had a lot of people say, well, why not one more year? And I just said, I just did one more year. I'd made my mind up sort of 12 months ago. This is what I want to do now.
I mean, you were able to end your career on your own terms, which also is you know, not the case for many, many riders. But how did that feel, Simon? I mean, going into an organization almost as a rookie again, I mean, in your mid-30s, I mean, you've got this incredible experience and, you know, recognition, if you like, and then going in almost at the bottom of the ladder. What was that experience like?
I was actually craving that. I was actually looking to start from the beginning somewhere all over again. For coming over, there's always this where for so many years, the latter part of my career, you were at the absolute top end and the expectation was always so high with everywhere. I was just actually really looking forward to just rolling up my sleeves, starting from scratch and learning a new trade. And I was able to do that in an environment where I was surrounded by some of the smartest people you find anywhere and some of the most successful people you find anywhere. So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed sort of my internship, which I did sort of over about a 5-month period before they offered me a permanent position in the bank. And how it unfolded, basically I was offered this position in a foreign exchange sort of sales team. At the time, my gut feeling was this is not quite the right fit for me. It was very tech heavy. It wasn't very relationship based. It was very, very transactional. And I thought this is not the right opportunity, but hey, it's not every day they're offering out jobs at Goldman Sachs. So I should take it, see what I can make of it. you know, I might sort of grow into the role. But I found after being there for a period of time, it wasn't quite right. And it was a huge sacrifice for both myself and my family. The fact that I was out the door most days at about 5 a.m., not home till sort of 7 p.m. at night, day in, day out. After so many years of racing and training really hard, I can say hand on heart, I've never been as tired as what I was when I was working at Goldman Sachs. So I really had to push myself. I got so far out of my comfort zone. I was studying for the first time in 20 plus years again. I had to pass all the regulatory exams. So that was just pushing myself in completely different ways. But at the end, you know, it resulted in I got a job, which was the first goal. It's like, okay, do this internship, learn as much as you can and try and get a job at the end of it, which I achieved. Once I was in that role, I kind of thought, okay, this is not the right role for me. This is not a long-term play. I don't think it's sustainable. So I should open my eyes for what other opportunities are out there. And that's what directed me towards a service course.
Oh, it's wonderful how many times you say I follow my gut feeling, because, you know, let's face it, being a very successful cyclist and then getting a job at Goldman Sachs, which is a big name, and you're surrounded by big people, still going to feel to where your gut wants you to go, looks like very courageous. And the moment you said it, you can just see the smile on your face. So the enjoyment must be real big in what you're doing today. Is that right?
Yeah, most definitely. And it sort of only occurred to me around the middle of this year that I know no other entry point bar the deep end. You know, I got out of professional sport and I was in sort of probably one of the most elite investment banks there are in the world. I step out of that into an executive role of basically a startup business where I'm just learning the whole time. Things are just coming at you left, right, and center. And every now and then from behind that you don't even see coming. And, you know, the next experience, you know, this year was my first experience in commentary, and it was, you know, live at the Tour de France. Really. So I've done a few snippets here and down then. It's like, and it was at that point it occurred to me, it's like I always end up just diving straight in the deep end. There's never just, oh, I'll just test the water here and see if I like it. It's bam, straight in 100%.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say there, Simon, also as we hear you talk about the Goldman's experience and reflecting on that, how what it sounds to me like, you know, like you were such a competitor. You were always wanting to be on the top step of the podium, win the biggest races. And from a career perspective, you can't get much more ambitious than a job at Goldman Sachs, right? So you clearly were setting your goal high based upon your vision as a winner. However, then you started to talk about what you started to understand as your talents. You know, you mentioned relationships being important to you. You mentioned family, you know, and integrating that is part of your wider career as being important to you. I mean, how has your thinking now evolved around what, you know, what are Simon Guerin's talents beyond being a talented bike rider? What are you really good at? What are your strengths? If I was to ask somebody, what is Simon awesome at besides riding a bike, what would they say?
I see always sort of found that my strengths are, you know, we've talked about work ethic and committing and being consistent, which are a big key, I think, to success in any sport or industry. But I think I'm good at building a culture and motivating people to get the best out of themselves. And I think I can build an environment with the team that I'm working with, where everybody is motivated to succeed. And I think what I've found over the years, it's finding what motivates people and how to motivate people to not only get the best out of themselves, but for them to contribute to getting the best out of the goal of the team or the organization. So that's sort of what I feel like is one of my strengths. And I kind of feel like I'm not the alpha male in the room. I don't have to be the one that is the center of attention. But I kind of feel like that I have the ability when required just to step up and lead a team or an organization and try and get the best out of people.
That is very inspiring. I think more people should really look the way you look at it, because You say you feel that. Can you give us an example of how you feel it? Meaning, like, is there an example, for example, that you can't wait to get to the people again the next day? Is there something tangible that you really feel like, oh, yes, this is really signals from within me that I need to do this?
Yeah. Actually, you know, it's one thing that I'm probably finding a bit of a challenge at the moment is working remotely and having the virtual contact with people for a few hours each day while I'm overlapped with the European European time frame from here in Australia is probably one of the challenges I'm going at the moment, because like we've talked about, I feel like I am a relationship type person, and I can sort of bring the best out of people when I'm in the environment with them. So one thing I'm going to have to a little adapt in my approach and learn how to go about things a little bit differently is to learn how to do that through a different means. But I kind of feel like throughout my racing career, one thing that I was able to do is basically when I put my hand up to lead a team, you know, I was able to step up and get the best result that I could on that day. And another thing that I've sort of found that later in my career, I was a guy that was sort of often called upon to help be the road captain at a race, is to also get the best out of a team. Even when I wasn't the guy that had to deliver the result, is that I kind of had the ability to get the best out of everybody in that environment. And I've quickly found myself in a new career outside of the sport in a kind of a leadership position again, because I think again, I can sort of get a group of people together and really get everybody to buy into the goal of the organization. So yeah, it's not something that, it feels like it's one of those things that I just keep getting pushed into that or finding myself in that position to be able to do that, whether I'm actively seeking that or not.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, Simon, as well, I mean, your experience at Goldman, and I'm sure the experience now, which is you're on a new path, and that also involves learning, right? As an athlete, you know, when you were competing for Liège or Milan-San Remo, you know, you knew the distance of the race. You knew how many altitude meters there were. So in a way, you could break that down to very, very specific training protocols and efforts and all the stuff around it, the nutrition and the weight loss and everything. So in a way, there was perhaps more of a formula there. How have you grappled with that moving into life beyond the peloton? Because actually, there's much more, in a way, complexity, ambiguity around how we achieve success in, say, the service course as a business than you would in training for a race. So how do you know what you should be learning? How do you know where you should be channeling your energy in this much more complex kind of setting now?
Well, I think the learning is a very important element of it. And one thing that I was always adamant of, that whatever I did after racing, I wanted to be in a career where I was going to be developing as a person and professionally. The last thing I wanted to do was find myself in a role where I was just regurgitating what I already knew. I would probably get very bored in that position very quickly. So I always wanted to be developing, you know, professionally. And I think that's why I was drawn to Goldman Sachs, because I could see there was such a huge scope of development that I could go through within that organization. So I guess sort of going back to your question is, for me, that has probably been one thing that I've always been drawn to, and the success of it, I think success is measured in different ways by different people, and you have to have a strong understanding of what success means to you, and everything else should just basically be white noise, because what you see as being a success may be way higher than what someone else sees as a successful result, and may be way lower than what somebody else sees as a successful result. But ultimately, I think when you come from a career in professional sport, you do set your standards pretty high.
We're both silent.
No, I guess there's an aspect to that though, Simon, because... Yeah. You know, I also saw many videos where you were not alone at races. Your wife, Rihanna, was also there. So can you talk about this a little bit in terms of not just the journey as a pro, but also the journey in making the transition post-professional cycling career and how your wife has played a role in that?
Oh, yeah, my wife, Rana, she's played a massive role. You know, she's my biggest supporter throughout. And, you know, I wouldn't have achieved the accomplishments I achieved at a sporting level without her support. She's kind of completely bought into my career. And, you know, she still really steers the ship at home now. So, I think it is very important that everybody in your sort of circle, and I think it's important to keep that circle pretty tight, is on board with what you're trying to achieve. Because as soon as you have sort of one person there that's doubting or that's trying to pull you in a direction away from that, that can make life very difficult and become a big distraction. So, you know, my home life has been very important and a huge part of my successes.
And you did allude to work-life balance with regard to the London job. To what extent was that sort of a realization that, you know, obviously, because there is a tension, right? Because as a winner, you want to be the best and you want to be, you know, achieving, you want to be recognized, but often that also comes with a sacrifice. So, you know, now that you're in your or beyond your mid-30s, you know, how do you reflect upon and how do you achieve a more balanced view of success when you have three young children, one on the way? Do you have a tendency to overwork to you know, get that out of balance a little bit?
Yeah, I do. And a nice balance is probably something that I've never found, because, you know, I'm probably a bit of a workaholic when it comes to it. But like I said, I'm really, really fortunate that I have a supportive family, and they know what I'm like. But one thing I tried to do that when I'm in the space with my family, I'm wholeheartedly in that space. You know, I try not to be distracted by work stuff. I might disappear for a month at a time to go and work, but when I'm at home for a weekend or when I'm doing something with the kids, I'm really trying to be 100% in that space. I knew the balance wasn't quite right when I was at Goldman's, and, you know, I'd rush home at the end of the day, be catching the tube or public transport, and you get home and, you know, you sit on the couch for the kids to read you a story, and I was asleep by the time that I was sort of one page in, because I was just so physically exhausted. And that's when I kind of realized that this is not the life that I want right now. I do want to be more present for my kids when I am at home.
Well, that means that there is quite a difference between the Simon that flew to Europe for the first time 22 years ago and the Simon that flew back to Australia to settle there now, like a few months ago, as you were saying. If you need to tell to people three main differences for yourself, obviously you got married and you have a family, but in your mind, what are three main differences that you came across that you would have never thought about coming over to Europe to race your bike?
Yeah, well, okay. We might have to wrap this up after this one, guys, because I do have to run off to a 9:30 meeting. But and we've been going for a little while now, so I don't want anyone to get too bored with that chat. But I guess one of the big main differences, I went over with one suitcase, you know, as a 19-year-old, and I came back 20 years later with two shipping containers worth of stuff, a wife and three kids. So I did accumulate quite a big life abroad. But I guess, you know, the experiences and the friendships that I built over in Europe. Like I said, I went over there. I didn't speak a word of Italian. I knew nobody really, a couple of Aussies that I knew that were scattered out around Europe racing their bikes. Now I could say that I have, you know, friends in, like good friends in most countries within Europe. So it's the people you meet throughout the processes, throughout that life that you build abroad that are so important. And I guess it's the life experiences. You know, you sort of evolve so much of a person. I've had over half of my life on the other side of the world from the area that I grew up. I grew up in a small country, like farming community, and then to sort of end up living in some of the biggest cities and most well-known places in the world, as well as to sort of competing at the highest level on the world stage. It's a heck of a long journey.
Excellent. Okay, Simon Gerrans, thank you very much for this insightful, open and very honest interview. For those of you who've been watching, if you have enjoyed the discussion, please do give us the thumbs up. And of course, please do subscribe to the This Cycling Life YouTube channel. So Bernard Moedermann, Simon Gerrans, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Simon.
Enjoyed the chat. Thank you.